Welcome back to this second hour of Leading Edge Medicine. Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning, and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians. All while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
And we're back with more Leading Edge Medicine. This is hour number two. Dr. Umat, she has the weekend off.
She does indeed. Hopefully yes. She's having fun.
I think she is. Dr. Jerry Mixon here taking your calls. If you have a question, we are live in the studio. Here's the number to call. 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. We are headed to Bellevue, and Randy is on the line. Hi there, Randy.
Hello, Randy.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Lynette.
Good morning,
Dr. Mixon.
How can we help you, sir?
Well, I'm a patient. Jerry, we know each other. I'll just mention aneurysm and you'll remember me.
I do.
I've been a patient for, I don't know how many years, probably 15 or more.
Quite a while.
And my wife is now a patient.
Good for her.
Couple of years, and my son just came to the Kirkland Clinic, and he's going to sign up as a patient.
Oh, good.
Wonderful. All in the family.
All in the family. And I wanted to talk a little bit. I don't know. I guess this is a medical/political issue. Gender-affirming care.
Yes.
Which I think is a real misnomer.
It is.
You have talked about this from time to time, and I seem to remember, and this is what I'm trying to have you confirm, that if a person has gender dysphoria, that they are five times more likely to commit suicide if they're taking gender-affirming drugs and if they think their sex assignment is wrong, but 11 times more likely than the general population to commit suicide if they've had surgery to remove body parts and, you know, put themselves in an irreversible situation. Do I have the numbers right? And if so,
well, you got the concept right. The precise numbers depend on which study you're looking at, though. I think the best study is a study that was done up in the North countries. It looked at Sweden and Denmark, and Norway. They have medical care systems in which every hospitalization is recorded. And the reasons that we were hospitalized, et cetera. So, and every diagnosis, even if you go to the doctor and you're in the office, the government has your diagnosis. Okay. And what that allows them to do, you know, personally, I don't want the government to have all my diagnoses, but that's their system. But it allows you to track long term how people do with specific diagnoses. And the North countries were, in fact, the very first people that started this transsexual reassignment. Way back in the 19, golly, I think,
yeah.
late 50s was their first Christine Keeler. So they've got a lot of experience with this, and they've been able to track it for long periods of time. And so here's the experience, and this is why they no longer do gender, quote, affirming care for children, because they have discovered that it doesn't help. In fact, it makes things worse in the long run. Gender dysphoria is a psychiatric diagnosis. It is a mental illness, an emotional disorder. And these are people who, for whatever reason, traumas in their childhood, genetic components, et cetera, are unhappy being what they are. And gender dysphoria is a dissociative disorder. It's closely related to multiple personality disorders, to delusional states where you think you're Jesus Christ or you think you're Genghis Khan or Abraham Lincoln or something. People who are really, really miserable being who and what they are. And this is a spectrum. I mean, I think most human beings envy other people at some point in their life. You wish you were taller. You wish you were shorter. You wish you were thinner. You wish you were stronger. You wish you were smarter. You know, we all have shortcomings that we envy other people to some degree. When that's focused on sexuality, there are people who wish from time to time they had the advantages that men have, or they have the advantages that women have. And that's perfectly fine, and that's normal. It occurs when you see other people getting stuff you don't get or treatments you don't get. But when it comes to the point that you honestly believe that you are something you are not, now you've moved into the focus or to the range of delusion. You honestly think you're a man who thinks he's a woman. You're a woman who thinks she's a man. And you do everything you can to imitate that other gender. You wear clothes that are traditionally associated with the other gender. You may either wear haircuts. You do everything you can to make yourself appear to be, to convince yourself and people around you that you are what you are not. Okay. And this is a serious psychiatric disorder when it gets to the point of delusion, because you've now lost touch with the objective world around you. You're believing things that simply are not true. That doesn't upset me especially. People have a right to live their own life the way they want to live it. Not my business, their life. When they try to convince me, though, that I have to share the delusional state, now we got an issue, because now they're impinging on my life. Okay. I reserve the right to live in objective reality. I just do. There's a phenomena in medicine. We know that people who get one cancer frequently have multiple cancers. Cancer formers form cancers. People with one vascular disease frequently develop multiple vascular disease. People with one autoimmune disease usually have three or four autoimmune diseases over time. People with one serious psychiatric disorder are prone to multiple psychiatric disorders. So a high percentage of people with gender dysphoria are somewhere on the autism spectrum. And depression, anxiety, maladjustment disorders of all sorts are very, very common in these folks. And as a consequence, yes, they are maladjusted and they are unhappy. And so they have a much higher instance of suicide. In general, people with gender dysphoria have a suicide rate that is generally about 4 to 5 times that of the general population, because they are far more unhappy with themselves than the general population. The best study done in the North countries lasted 30 years. They were able to look at everyone in their countries that had gender dysphoria and track them for 30 years. They looked at people that had psychiatric interventions. They looked at people that had hormonal interventions. They looked at people that had surgical interventions. They looked at people that basically had no interventions. And they were able to track every single hospitalization, every single suicide attempt, every single successful suicide. And what they found was over a 30-year period, the suicide episode in people who were treated with gender-affirming care went from 4 to 5 times that of the general population to over 19 times that of the general population. So cross-sex hormones and amputating body parts does not solve a psychiatric disorder. Mm-hmm. Okay? Surgery is not the answer to a psychiatric problem. you know, that's the wrong intervention. And so, yes, these folks are sick. They have problems. It doesn't mean we hate them or we dislike them any more than you hate people that have diabetes or heart disease or cancer. You know, as a physician, our goal is to help them, but we've taken the wrong path. And most of the world has recognized this. The National Health Service in England has now totally stopped treating children with cross-sex hormones and or surgical intervention. The North countries throttled back years ago because they, being able to track their people more closely than we can, showed them the error of their ways. So, you know, we're doing it wrong. We just are. We're harming them more than we're helping. So these unfortunate folks need help, but they don't necessarily need everyone else on the planet to reaffirm their delusions. If somebody thought they were Jesus Christ, would we all accept that they are Jesus? If they all think they're Genghis Khan, will we get on our horses and ride them to conquer Europe? Come on. The fact is that these folks are sick. They need help. They need intervention. They don't need what our legislature is mandating that we give them. Our legislators are wrong. Politicians have no business mandating medical care and standards. So, does that make my position clear?
It makes your position clear, and it's the same position that I've heard on. You're very consistent, and I agree totally.
Well, I follow the science. What can I tell you?
And my challenge that I have is that I tend to be outspoken. My wife has accused me of giving people unwanted advice at times.
Well,
and this topic has come up, and what I've told people is, look, you're not changing anything. The sex is immutable. If you have an XY chromosome pair, you're going to be a woman, and that XY is present in every cell of your body.
If you're XX, you're a woman. XY is male.
Oh, well, correct.
The Y chromosome is male.
I tend to think for them. I apologize. I always get it right in the discussion, but on the radio, I'm not too smart. Anyway, if it is immutable and it cannot be changed, then the fact is there have been no successful reassignment surgeries ever. The number of them is zero.
Yeah, but we can do a better surgical job of imitating the other gender. We just can't make you the other gender. And there's a difference. We've got a break we have to take, but I'll be back here in about a minute or so.
Yeah, stay right there, Randy. And Roger and Jim will be talking with you in just a moment. And phone lines are available if you'd like to get in the queue with your question for Dr. Jerry Mixon today. It's 206-421-5757. We'll be right back. It's Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon, brought to you, of course, by Longevity Medical Clinics. We're here every Saturday morning, and we are live. And you can get through with your questions by calling 206-421-5757. And we're on the phone with Randy from Bellevue right now and Dr. Mixon.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that concerns me about this whole thing is that this is this politicalization of medicine. Because medicine's supposed to be based on science, not politics. Mm. And there's a conflation of different things because most of the transsexual, the dysphoric people are in fact simply homosexual. They've carried it to an extreme. If a man is attracted to other men, he may want to think he's a woman. If a woman is attracted to other women, she may want to think that she's a man. But the reality is homosexual behavior is common in all mammals. not just in humans. This is not necessarily a learned behavior. We know, for instance, that a certain percentage of sheep will only mate with other sheep. A certain percentage of birds will only nest with other birds of the same gender. This is not even just a mammal thing. Avians do the same thing. I have no idea about, you know, reptiles.
Reptiles.
But, or fish. But animals, there is a discrete percentage, usually 2 to 4%, that are rigidly homosexual in every species, whether it's sheep, cattle, horses, humans, dogs. Hell, there's been a whole lot of male dogs that seem to fall in lust with my leg. And I'm not even their species.
No, you're not.
Much less
Definitely not.
Of their species. But the reality is, this is different from the transgender. This is not an emotional. For some reason, you know, this is something has gone awry in the reproductive behaviors of some animals, and humans are not immune to that. And in humans, it seems to be a spectrum again. There are a small number of men who would die rather than have intercourse with a woman. There's a small number of women who would rather die than have intercourse with a man. But there's a larger spectrum that, in the right circumstances, can go either way. Hmm. And we see this a lot in the gang members, the criminal element. You've got young men that are very proud of their prowess of seducing and making babies with women, until you lock them up in a prison with no women. And now you have these young men with a very strong sex drive and no female outlet. And guess what? Homosexual behavior becomes very common in same gender prisons among men and women. When you turn them loose and the other gender is now available to them, they revert to heterosexual behaviors. So there is the potential to go either way in a large number of people, especially in youth, when the drives are extremely strong and there are either social or practical restrictions on their expressing it with their preferred partner. Okay? So, you know, it psychologically, there's an enormous spectrum of sexual behaviors, but there's a difference in sexual behaviors and gender. You are male or you are female. You are a man who is rigidly hetero, is bi, or is homo, and that spectrum can go to virtually any degree in any given individual. So, you know, we should not be conflating that with the gender dysphoria transsexual phenomena. That is quite different. So, anyway,
all right.
I give in my speech.
I hear what
there you
you're
go.
Saying. Okay. I heard what you said, and I agree with you. But my concern, and the reason I called, is primarily concern for our children.
Yes.
Because,
yeah.
And grandchildren.
You know, if you're in a situation where sex, what you think you are, is somewhat plastic or can be.
Yes,
until
it
you
is.
Become an adult. That's what I understand. So, mm-hmm. You know, when you're 5, 6 years old, you know, you, as Johnny may think it would be really nice to be Sally.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But children accept adult comments as facts.
Yep, absolutely.
And if we keep lying to our kids and saying, well, Johnny, you can be Sally. You know, we can completely change and reassign your sex. That's baloney. That's never going to happen.
Well, except...
And I think we...
Well, I agree with you. It is wrong, but... In Washington State, our state legislature requires that the teachers lie to the children. You have to realize that. In order to be recognized as a legal school in this state, they have to teach according to the state gender guidelines, which means they are required by law to lie to the kids.
I know that. And that's why I'm hoping that every listener like me is paying attention right now. We need to turn these people around. And there are well-meaning people who do not understand that sex is immutable.
No,
a lot of people on the street, if you have a conversation, they say, oh, yeah, it can be changed.
Sure.
And I think we have an obligation to our children to let people know what the facts are. We can't continue to lie to them.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you what. Let me tell you what happened. If you hear it often enough and loud enough from authority figures, you may accept it. And children are prone to that.
Yeah, 6 to 7 hours a day.
Let me tell you what happened with my daughter. We, you know, she's in a private school, and she came home. We got an email from the school. They were going to give the gender section. And I sent an email to the school. I said, I'd like to know exactly what you're going to teach. They said, well, we have to teach by the state mandated. And I said, can you, you know, tell me what that is? And so they sent me a link, and I looked up the state requirement. And it is bullpucky. It is absolute, you know, progressive lies and cheating. They're just misleading the children. My daughter is a bit precocious. At 11 years old, she knows the biological facts. And so I had to send a note to the teachers. And I said, you know, here's what's happening. My daughter knows about XXXY, SRY genes and translocations. Said, she is well aware that you have no choice but to lie to her. And so she's not going to be mad at you. Said, but she is a aggressive little thing. And I don't know whether she's going to stay quiet to avoid embarrassing you or whether she's going to stand up and speak the scientific truth to your political lies. And whatever she decides to do, I will support her. So apparently they got enough emails from other parents that they put it off for several weeks while they figured out how to stay strictly within the legal guidelines, but tell the kids the least a number of lies necessary to stay in out of trouble with the state. And so they revamped it and they toned it down significantly. Parents talking to the schools and talking to the school boards can have an impact. And if enough parents refuse to go along with political stupidity, the politicians will get the message. But of course, the best way to give them the message is throw the scoundrels out and put sane people in who recognize objective reality.
Yes.
Right. And we have an opportunity to do that in a few months.
Yes, we do.
All right. I need to move along.
Thank you so much for the conversation, Randy.
Bye-bye, sir.
All right. Just a few minutes until our next break. Why don't we at least get the question from our next caller, take the break, and then we'll discuss it. Roger from Whidbey Island is on the line. Hi, Roger. How can we help you today?
Yes, Dr. Mixon. I just turned 80 last month.
And congratulations.
It's about my prostate.
Okay.
Imagine that. my MRI report August of last year reads finding concerning diffuse malignancy, IRADS 5. My question is, I'm trying to, of course, put off the biopsy as long as I can. I heard you mention something about a 4K test before I do the biopsy.
Mm-hmm.
Does longevity do 4K tests?
Oh, sure.
Of which I am a member. And guess what? August of last year, of course.
Okay.
I came back home. Anyway, so yes, 4K first.
4K first. Although if your MRI is looking suspicious for a diffuse malignancy, that's kind of spooky. Yeah. All right, we got to take a break just because of the time, but we'll be right back and we'll chat about this a little more.
Yes, stay right there, Roger. Good morning. It is Leading Edge Medicine taking a break and back with more calls. Here's the number, 206-421-5757. We'll be right back.
Yeah. I'm ready to play
today. And we're back. Good morning. I'm Lynette. Dr. Jerry Mixon here, and we're talking with caller Roger from Whidbey Island about his prostate results.
Now, Roger, did I hear that clearly? You said your MRI showed diffuse malignancy in the prostate?
And differential, including acute prostatitis. That's the rest of it.
Oh, yes. Prostatitis. Okay. All right. Okay. Yeah, that makes more sense. Because I got to tell you, I have never in 50 years of medical practice seen a diffuse prostate cancer throughout the prostate. That just, it just boggles my mind. Because, you know, that would be a cancer that basically replaced the entire prostate.
Hopefully not. But here's my situation. I'm currently on a catheter, of course. Uh-huh. Next Thursday, the plug is pulled, and we see if I can pee for a couple of hours.
Good.
If that's the case, fine, and I'll probably have to go ahead and do the biopsy anyway. But if I can't pee, then it gives me more time to really think about it. Now, what I'm thinking about is the transperineal instead of the regular at random situation. Well, of course, that's uh-huh. a random tube, still
yes,
more guided.
Yes.
And it would be MRI directed. It's done out of a VA is taking care of me. They're good folks.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And so, if you were in the situation my PSA, by the way, is 21. It's down from 37 8 months ago because I was, you know, joined longevity.
All right.
And off of testosterone. So, 21 PSA. What would you do in that situation?
My guess is that this is a diffuse prostatitis. Now, you may also have some prostate cancer hiding in there. But and a prostatitis causing inflammation and swelling and high PSA could hide the cancer, so you would not see it as clearly on the MRI. But that's my guesstimate. So, you know, I'm pretty sure you probably got a prostatitis. You may or may not have a cancer hiding along with the prostatitis. You know, prostatitis is infection and inflammation in the prostate. There's mm-hmm. nothing about that inflammation that precludes coexisting cancer, especially in an 80-year-old. So I guess...
does 4K test help in any of that diagnosis? Does that help?
With that much inflammation and that high a PSA... My guess is the 4K is going to be kind of unreliable. Yeah, the components of the PSA though, the free versus protein bound component would probably be fairly accurate. You know, the PSA the 4K is just a urine test anyway, so I mean it's non-invasive. It's one of those things that I see no harm in getting it done. But it is one of those things that if I were in your situation, I would want to have my longevity doctor call and talk to the pathologist at the laboratory that is running the 4K and explain your clinical situation and get the advice of that pathologist, because he knows his tests and what will make it run awry better than my doctors do. Because that is his field of expertise. So I don't know who your doc is, but I'd ask your doc to pretty please call whoever is the laboratory director at the lab that is going to do the 4K and talk to them about its accuracy or inaccuracy in your situation.
Sounds like a plan. Real quickly then, yes, I've taken the Galleri test, and I have mm-hmm. no cancer at all. Of course, that's
good.
Weak on the area of both prostates.
It's weak on prostates, unfortunately, yeah.
Right. Now, okay, transperineal. Have you heard anything about that as far as not going through the dirty part of the body?
Well, I mean, it's easier to sterilize the perineum, you know, that area between the scrotum and the anus. That at least is skin, and it doesn't have all the bacteria and so on. So your risk of getting an inflammatory process or an infection carried from the bowel into that sterile prostate. Of course, if you've got a prostatitis that is that big and diffuse, it's not sterile in there anyway, but at least it would be different bugs. I think the perineal approach is perfectly fine. Should work well for your purposes.
Good. I'm taking Flomax, Tadalafil, and Finasteride, so hopefully next Thursday I can see. We'll see what happens.
I hope. Anyway. All right.
Yes, exactly. Can't thank you enough. Thank you, Doctor.
You're welcome, appreciate sir. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for the call, Roger. We are headed to Duval. Jim is on the line with a question for Dr. Mixon. It's Leading Edge Medicine. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you both for being there.
You're welcome. You're welcome. How can we help, sir?
Well, a 67-year-old male. I've got about 8 years ago, I was diagnosed with COPD emphysema, basically. Mm-hmm. Earlier this month, I came down with pneumonia, which I'm, of course, susceptible to. I had it last August also. But while I was in the urgent care, they had an issue deciding whether or not I should go into cardio ward or into the pulmonary. They ended up putting me into the cardio. Now, I've never had any issues with my heart, but they were really concerned because my heart was racing and my blood pressure. Well, at the time I had 103 degree temperature. I was really sick.
Wow.
Once they brought everything down, things seemed to smooth out, but my heart rate still stayed pretty high. They were giving me something to lower the heart rate, which would last for a while, but then it would start to jump again. So, once I was out, my doctor got me an appointment with a cardiologist who basically said, well, you've got atrial fibrillation. We're going to get you on blood thinners and a beta block. And in 4 weeks, we'd like to get you into I don't know the name of the process, but they basically shock your heart to try to get it back into
cardioversion. Yeah, they do a cardioversion.
Correct. All this came on out of nowhere, and I'm just curious. Ever since COVID, I don't want to get political here, but ever since COVID, I've been really skeptical of the medical fields, which is why I listen to you and why I call you for an opinion. Okay. Less is better, in my opinion, and I'm really concerned about starting to take blood thinners that I might have to take the rest of my life, and I'm just wondering if I should ask if I could get another EKG and maybe some more blood work before we get this drastic, or what's your opinion?
Well, the question is whether you went into atrial fibrillation as a result of hypoxia and fever with your pneumonia. I mean, the first part of that story makes perfectly good sense. You've got chronic pulmonary disorder. You don't oxygenate yourself well. So your mild chronic hypoxia, then you get pneumonia, your oxygen levels drop even more. Low oxygen levels will make the heart speed up trying to get enough blood oxygen to your tissues. The fever makes everything go into high gear. So again, you've got a good reason to get a speedy heart rate. And probably during that period of stress is when you went into atrial fib. Atrial fibrillation in of itself in a young person is not as big a concern, but atrial fibrillation decreases your cardiac output, your heart's ability to pump blood to your brain and body by about 15 to 20%. So, a young person's got enough reserve that dropping 15, 20%, they still do okay. Older people, our hearts are not as strong. We're not pumping as much blood to start with. And you're not as well oxygenated because of your COPD, and you get atrial fibrillation. That now becomes a more serious concern. So I see why they would want you in the cardiac unit, hoping that you were not going to have a disaster. And thank heavens you didn't. The question, of course, is where to go from here. The longer you're in atrial fibrillation, the lower your chances of going back into a normal sinus rhythm and staying there long term. So I'd like to get that cardioversion done as quickly as practical, simply because time is important. The longer you're in fib, the higher risk you're going to stay in fib or go back into fib after the conversion is done. I'm not a big fan of beta blockers, although I know they're first-line drugs frequently for a whole lot of cardiologists. I generally prefer calcium channel blockers to this. And we have to take a break. You hear the music? I'll tell you why when we get back.
Yes, we'll be back with more Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and your phone calls in just a moment. Stay right there. We're back. It's Leading Edge Medicine. My name is Lynette here with Dr. Jerry Mixon, and we're talking with Jim on the line about AFib and blood thinners. And we just had one last comment, Dr. Mixon. Yeah.
The biggest worry with atrial fibrillation is stroke. When that top two chambers in your heart are just kind of fibrillating, they're just kind of wiggling and not contracting. You get stagnant blood flow around the edges, and they can actually form a clot. We call it a mural thrombus, a clot that forms over the entire upper side, the walls of that chambers. And then if you suddenly go into a normal sinus and that contracts, that clot can be broken free and pump out and either cause a pulmonary embolism or a stroke. And so we don't want either one of those. So that's why they're going to anticoagulate you for a while to give that clot time to dissolve and be reabsorbed before they do the conversion. So they've got two competing things. They need to get any clots you've got sitting in those atria cleared out before they do the conversion. At the other hand, they want to do the conversion as quickly as practical because they know the longer you're in atrial fibrillation, the less chance the conversion will be effective long term.
Okay, doctor. It sounds like you're in favor of the procedure.
I think you need to get it done. I hope that it's effective for you and that you stay in sinus. Then you won't need blood thinners anymore.
Yeah, that would be good. I guess the last thing is I've had no symptoms, none at all, no racing heart, no. The only way they can detect it is through the EKG. Is that pretty common?
That's very common. The other way that you can sometimes protect is just check your pulse. If it's nice and even, you're usually not in atrial fibrillation. If it is irregular, if it doesn't have a pattern to it, it goes fast, slow, fast, skip, skip, two, three at a beat, slow, back and forth, that's usual atrial fibrillation. Okay, an irregular pulse is suspicious for atrial fib.
Okay, really good to know. Well, thank you very much, doctor. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome, sir. Take care. Good luck.
All right. Thank you, Jim, for that. Headed to Buckley now. Jerry is on the line. Hi, Jerry. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. First off, Doc, I applaud you for articulating your position on the gender issue. It's reassuring that there's still a few voices of sanity, reason, and common sense that haven't been silenced yet in our upside down world. But moving beyond that, Doc, I have increasing eye pressure, not glaucoma yet, but my doc is concerned about it. And over the years, I've read various articles that talk about the use of cannabis to reduce eye pressure. Mm-hmm. And it seems that more and more I read things to say, well, maybe not such a good idea, could actually make it worse. I'm wondering if you have any experience with that.
No experience at all. Okay. Michael, if you're listening.
Dr. Michael Gilbert.
Yeah. Dr. Michael Gilbert is the ophthalmologist of choice. He's my consultant on this. He's frequently on the show, and he will know precisely, I'm willing to bet. I'm one of the few adults of my generation that seems to have gotten through 76 years without ever trying cannabis.
I tried it when I was younger, but haven't touched it in many years and don't really want to. Yeah. Okay, and Dr. Gilbert is my doc, but that didn't come up in conversation, yeah. So well, maybe I'll need to do that.
Yeah, give him a call. If listen to the last 7 minutes of this show, he may call in. Mm-hmm. I know he listens to us a lot. But if not, well, this is one of those things. You could call his office, and I'll bet you anything that one of the doctors there, because you know Michael Jr. is also an ophthalmologist there in his practice. So
yeah, Junior's my doc. Hey, one other quick question. Sure. I also have read of possible health benefits with infrared sauna and hyperbaric treatment. You have an opinion on either?
Infrared sauna, it's basically vasodilatation. I don't know how it penetrates deep enough to do all the wonderful things that I'm hearing ascribed to it. I'm not sure about that one. Hyperbaric, I also have some reservations. If you could be in hyperbaric chamber several hours every day, I can see that it can do all kinds of wonderful things because it's driving oxygen at higher concentrations and higher pressures right through your tissues, saturating you with oxygen far more efficiently than we do here at sea level with our normal air pressure. But I see people do it for 1 hour once a week, and then they're described that the other 23 hours of that day and 24 hours of every other day of the week, they have normal pressures and normal oxygenation. Why would 1 hour out of hundreds of hours a week be all that effective? Mm. It doesn't somehow pass the smell test with me.
Well, I very much honor your opinion, and I appreciate you. I appreciate your input.
All right. Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, Jerry. Time for one more question. We've got John on the line from Vancouver, Washington. Hi there, John.
Hi there. Thank you very much for your military service, doctor. I got a quick question on vitamin E. I called your store and asked them if they had the vitamin E that had the full spectrum, the eight vitamin E.
Yep.
She said they only had the one with four. And I just wondered what four do you emphasize?
No, it's actually, there's two things. It also lists the mixed tocopherols in it. So it does have all eight. So I don't know who you talk to, but I designed it.
It does.
Yes. So it has both, it has four tocopherols and four tocotrienols. Yes.
That's what got her confused, I guess. Okay, yeah. You might mention that to her. But anyway, my second question is, what was the name of the nation that did that 30-year test you mentioned a while ago?
Sweden, actually.
Sweden.
Yeah.
That'd be great to reference that so we don't go off of...
Well, in fact, hang on one second. Let's see. I've got my computer here. Let me see if I've got this in my database that I can find quickly, okay? Let's see. I need to go to Dr. Teaching Materials. And there I'm going to look at... Now that's not what I'm looking for. Oh, darn it. Okay, maybe one more place. I've got several thousand papers that I have collected over the years.
Sure.
He's speed reading right now.
Actually, I'm fumbling through the index looking for what I do. Okay, Dr. Teaching Files. Open that up. Cognitive. Looking for a transsexual. Thymus T-cell regressions. Darn. And we're almost out of time.
Yeah, we're coming up on a minute.
We got about a minute to go. But yeah, I've got some papers that I pulled for the doctors to review, and I will try to make a point or call us early in the show next week, and I will hunt up the paper for you and give you the exact name of the paper so that you can search for it, okay?
Okay, thank you very much, Doctor. I appreciate that. I want to start a campaign down here in Clark County to get rid of that junk that's going around here in our schools, especially.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Well, unfortunately, the schools have to because it's a state law. What you have to get rid of...
Well, we have to pass the state law, yeah.
Yeah, you have to get rid of your state legislators. Okay, that's what you got
to
do.
I'm trying very hard to do that.
All right. Take care, sir.
Thank you, John.
Bye-bye.
All right. And that's our show for this week. We do want to remind you about our Heart Health Day, and that's coming up next month, which is actually just a few days away, on Thursday, May 9th, at all three of our longevity clinics in Kirkland, Tacoma, and in Linwood. You do need to make an appointment for this test. There is a cost, and you can get more information and make your appointment by calling 1-866-86-YOUNG. That's 866-86-YOUNG. That's our show. We're back next week live in the studio with Dr. Mixon and Dr. Umat. On behalf of Leading Edge Medicine, I'm Lynette. Have a great rest of your weekend, and thank you for listening.